Today's podcast is sponsored by David M. Hosmer Law Office, which is celebrating David's 30th year practicing law. You may not need a lawyer, but when you do, you need an excellent one. Contact him at davidhosmer@hotmail.com.
Welcome to Yankton's Yardbirds, a podcast presenting the World War II stories of Yankton's veterans. After 165 interviews and countless hours of preparation, it's time to share these stories. As of now, they'll be shared by podcast and later will be presented in print. If you have questions, free to contact me at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. Please be advised that there is some offensive language within these interviews. When I'm speaking, I've edited my language to more modern times. Today is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. On this day in 1941, 2,403 Americans were killed by the Japanese in a surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, located Oahu in Hawaii. It was the impetus for America to declare war and to fight around the world for over three more years. I was fortunate to have interviewed three men who survived the attacks and several men who were there a few days before the attack. Sundays at Pearl Harbor were generally relaxing and uneventful. Sunday, the 7th of December, 1941, was Werner Klemm's opportunity to take liberty. He was eager to go ashore because he wanted to visit a friend on the USS California, and together they planned a drive to see a blowhole beyond Waikiki Beach. High winds shot up water 30 feet in the air. Dressed in his last clean suit of whites, he headed to the deck for the display of the morning colors. Some men still had to work, however. Bob Titterington was on kitchen patrol. He told me as he moved his hand with his knife in a cutting action, I was peeling potatoes. Same was true for Eugene Dwyer. On weekends, the non-commissioned officers rotated the officer in charge of quarters, duties that included preparing the morning reports. Somebody had to stay on base, and it was Eugene's turn to be the OCQ. After delivering the morning reports to headquarters and the sick report to the base hospital, he strolled back to his squadron office. It was a few minutes before 8 a.m. That's when it all started, he said. The men in the 147th Field Artillery arrived at Pearl Harbor aboard the converted passenger liner USAT Willard A. Holbrook on November 26th and departed a mere 4 days later on their way to the Philippines. General Douglas MacArthur needed more men, and that included the 147th. According to Arnold Albrecht, as the Willard Holbrook departed, a band dressed in beautiful red uniforms and wearing no shoes played Roll Out the Barrel. The ship sailed due south. I asked Don Modrigger, who was there, had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before that? No, he quickly replied. I thought one of the fellows dated her. Don must have practiced that line for years. This podcast is certainly about World War II. However, the stories of these veterans are my focus. To some, the veterans are fathers and mothers. For others, they may be grandparents or even great-grandparents, so it can be personal. You'll even hear some audio recordings of some veterans. Even if these podcasts are not personal, they're still important. Author and broadcaster Tom Brokaw referred to the people who won the peace as the greatest generation. They are fascinating people who witnessed great change in America. They'll provide you with sage words of advice, especially on the impact of war on us as a people. Elmo Christensen, for example, grew up in Yankton and graduated from Yankton High School in 1940. Although he should have graduated in 1938, he was told that he had a leaky heart, so he sat out an entire 9 months of school year. He returned the following year and spent a lot of time on his bicycle, but he said it was to avoid school. He said, I learned a lot more on my bicycle than I ever did in school. In 1940, he enlisted in the Coast Guard. When asked why he joined, he said, I didn't know what else to do. At his physical examination, which would be used to determine if he should enter the Coast Guard, he was rejected because he was too short. He went back a second time to Omaha, and apparently he grew because they accepted his enlistment. Elmo was assigned a lifeboat station at Point Bonita, California, located on the ocean side of the mouth into the San Francisco Bay in California. He said it was incredibly beautiful. One of Elmo's best friends in the Coast Guard was a man named Robards. His family lived in San Francisco, and his father was a captain aboard a merchant marine ship. Robards took Elmo to all of the good places. One particular dance hall north of Sausalito was a lot of fun, but he couldn't get a dance with a pretty girl because there were so many sailors. Some businesses did not like all the sailors stationed around San Francisco. It was not uncommon to read signs that said, "Dogs and sailors not allowed." However, according to Elmo, the day after Pearl Harbor, you couldn't buy a drink. They were all free. All the signs came down. World War II changed our views about veterans. The veterans of World War I received a $60 bonus, which was 60 bucks more than the veterans of the Spanish-American War, but it was meager. Congress, over President Coolidge's veto, approved a much larger veterans pension in 1924. Each veteran was given a certificate that guaranteed payment in 1945. The amount of which depended on the time in service. A veteran could borrow up to 22% of the certificate, and that was increased to 50% in 1931 due to the Great Depression. But men couldn't wait until 1945. Times were tough. They wanted an early payout of their pension. Some 17,000 veterans marched on Washington, D.C. in 1932. When their demands were not met, they camped on government property as a form of protest. Those veterans, commonly referred to as the Bonus Army, were forcibly removed by the regular army at the point of guns and tanks during the summer of 1932. Contrast that pre-war image of veterans as dogs and evicted bums with the post-war GI Bill created in the June of 1944. The GI Bill guaranteed every veteran in active duty for at least 90 days the right to low-cost mortgages, low-cost loans to start a business or farm, 1 year of unemployment compensation, and dedicated payments of tuition and living expenses to attend high school, college, or vocational school. Today, it's common to walk into a grocery store and see a person wearing a hat that identifies the branch or unit that the veteran served in. They're greeted with a smile and oftentimes thanked for their service. Any member of Congress who dares to cut veterans' benefits today would face a tough re-election. Americans today are more than willing to help veterans as a way of saying thank you for your sacrifice. I believe that you either love to read about World War II, or you're just too frightened to pick up the topic. I love history, but I still avoided reading World War II topics for years because it was so massive. The number of books presenting World War II themes seemed endless. I was only lured into this topic because of a book about World War I, commonly referred to as the Great War by many historians. 2012, Gretchen Skoblik, a longtime friend, suggested that I read Richard Rubin's The Last of the Doughboys. The author told his stories of meeting the last six living American soldiers who fought during the Great War. I was left with one emotion. How sad it is to see these men pass before our eyes. Their firsthand history was quickly fading. Doug Haar, another friend of mine, teaches history at Yankton High School. We spent considerable time in deep discussion about historical themes. One day during the summer of 2013, we sat at Starbucks, sipping on a cup of coffee, and I mentioned The Last of the Doughboys. And just at that moment, here comes Cliff Hicks. He was my math teacher during my first year of high school in 1982. We hadn't seen each other in years. And Doug immediately said, "Are you a World War II veteran?" My head turned toward Cliff as he said that he was. He'd been a member of the 147th Field Artillery, which had departed Pearl Harbor just a few days prior to the attack. I was dumbstruck because I had no idea at all of his service. "You never asked," said Hicks. It was at that moment that I had the feeling I had experienced while reading The Last of the Doughboys. How sad it would be for these veterans and their stories to disappear. We had to do something. We agreed it would be a great idea to preserve their stories. Doug and I began in earnest to interview veterans beginning in March of 2014. Joe Reynolds was our first. Doug had a wonderful idea how to spread their stories and to publicly honor them at the same time. So on the 5th of May, 2014, 55 World War II veterans attended a ceremony at the Yankton High School. I'm looking at that photograph now. As I move my eye from man to man, I can name every single one of them. I can name them all. They all became my friends. And now, almost all of them are gone. At this moment, there are about 9 surviving World War II veterans in the greater Yankton area. What remains are their stories. And I will do my absolute best to make them proud. I hope you join me in this journey as I present Yankton's Yardbirds. A Yardbird is slang for an inexperienced military recruit. This podcast will begin in earnest throughout December as I begin to tell the stories of the Yardbirds who fought in the Allied battles in the Pacific Ocean. It will begin with Pearl Harbor and end in the American occupations in Korea, China, and Japan. Along the way, you'll meet about 110 veterans and some other interesting eyewitnesses. You'll also be introduced to 46 men and women from the Yankton area and Bonhom areas who perished while serving their country. When this series is complete, we'll then move on to the battles of the Atlantic, Europe, and North Africa. Sailor John Simple will have our last word until our next podcast. John was told that a family member had died, so he received leave to return to South Dakota to attend the funeral. After the funeral, John was dropped off at the bus station located at 3rd and Lynn in Yankton. He planned to board a bus for Sioux City, Iowa, where he'd then catch a train headed to the West Coast. After he sat down, a fellow in an Army uniform approached him. "Would you mind switching seats? I'd like to sit next to my wife." John looked over to his left and saw the young lady, and then looked up and saw where the other man had been seated, where he was going to trade. A pretty young girl was sitting next to that vacant seat. John smiled to himself and readily agreed. John plopped down in the bus seat and started a conversation. The time flew by. He discovered that this charming gal was named Darlene Friedel. She, too, was on her way to Sioux City, bound for the very same train. Ever the courteous gentleman, he told her that the train from Sioux City is always full of military personnel who had priority. However, if she wanted to make certain that she had a seat, then he was willing to help her. She was curious and asked how he might arrange this, and John suggested that they pretend that they were married. This would mean that they were together, and her seat would be guaranteed. She must have either doubted him or was simply coy. They both alit from the bus and parted after pleasant goodbyes. And then she reappeared. He was right. The train was full. She agreed to the ruse. As John said to me, "I pretended she was my wife, and 2 years later, I made her my wife." They married on May Day, 1947. I hope you'll join me this December as I present several podcasts of Pearl Harbor and the immediate aftermath of that sneak attack.
If you are interested in sponsoring an episode of Yankton's Yardbirds, please contact David Hosmer at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. All content for this podcast was created by David Hosmer, and all production was performed by Eric Berenger. Thank you for listening to this episode of Yankton's Yardbirds.